guest tonight from the Wyoming Humanities Council is Tom Ray. He's a freelance writer and editor living in Casper. He received his MFA in creative writing from the University of Montana and has served as writer in residence for the Wyoming Arts Council. He needs to explain that. Okay. He is the author of several books about Wyoming, including Devil's Gate, Owning the Land, Owning the Story, A History of Independence Rock, Devil's Gate, and Martin's Cove. The Wyoming Humanities Council presents tonight's program as part of its 2007 Humanities Forum. The Humanities Forum and other council programs explore the human experience, our lives, our communities, our world, in partnership with non-profit organizations across Wyoming. Emphasis is placed on fostering discussion among Wyoming residents. And for some of you that may have come in later, there's a paper wandering around here, a clipboard that we need signatures, just your signatures. We don't really need addresses. We'd like to know who all's here tonight. The state has a form for us to send back in, and we need a head count. Would appreciate you taking care of that. Please please join me in welcoming Tom Ray.
Thanks so much. It's nice to be here. And while we're getting set up here, I just wanted to say a couple things also about the Historical Society. I subscribe to the Annals, and I bet many of you do also. As part of my... Can you all hear me okay?
As part of the work I do as a writer in my life, this year I'm very lucky to have a contract with the Natrona County School District. They have something there called the American History Cowboy Coalition, which is a federal grant to help train teachers to teach history. And they've hired me to write up 28 different episodes in Wyoming history that will eventually be available online and electronically, I think. But all I'm really telling you this for is to tell you how heavily I use the Annals as I go through time, teach myself more about the history of Wyoming and write up these episodes. Most of them are 5 or 10 pages long, and it's a great excuse for me to learn about all kinds of miscellany of subjects that I've been curious about for some time. I won't go on at great length, but I also wanted to say something else, which I'll just remember as soon as in a minute.
This is a little bit of an advertisement here. This is my own book, which I'll talk about here directly. But I
think we're pretty much ready to go. Pretty much. Not quite.
Something's just not. Well, you know the joke about the three engineers riding in the car. There's a mechanical engineer, chemical engineer, and a computer engineer. And the car just stops. And the mechanical engineer says, "I'm sure it's the cam. We've got to get out and get under the hood and see it." So they do that. It doesn't work. And then the chemical engineer says, "I'm sure it's the gas in the tank." And that doesn't work either. Computer engineer says, "Well, how about if we all just get out of the car, close the doors, and then get back in again?" So if you don't mind, I'm going to shut this all down and start it back from the beginning, okay? This is just the thing that does the control.
So you got two computers going here, and if necessary, we can do it without the pictures, but it would be nice to have the pictures. So all I want to say is I'm a heavy user of the Annals of Wyoming, and I like it.
And I like it very much, and the new issue, for example, has a great article about Liberate and Johnson, what really happened, not what those other books you might have read said happened. And then another one that I really like, that I'm looking forward to reading, about an assistant to the pioneer photographer, William Henry Jackson, who, if we can get these pictures back up, you'll see several of these tonight. And then the other thing I wanted to say was, she said you wanted to ask me about being a writer in residence for the Arts Council. Last time I was in Afton was just about, I think, 25 years ago when I was here on behalf of the Arts Council teaching poetry in the schools, which is what I used to do in a former life, was go around Wyoming, Montana, and teach a lot of writing.
Let's see if we can get this. Powering down. Still powering down. I will tell you tonight that the name of this talk is Martin's Cove, Public Land, Sacred Land. I wrote this book. I worked at the Casper Star Tribune for many, many years, covering education and covering the legislature. And I while I was there one time, I got to go on a tour.
Is everybody to hear you? Then you have to speak into that microphone. That says that we're late comers.
I see. All right.
Thank you. Back up a little bit.
From the mic?
Well, no, you're kind of here. Now it works.
Okay. Can everybody hear me okay? Okay. This will be just fine here, just shortly. I did want to tell you about this book, that my interest in that country out there around the Sun Ranch and along the Sweetwater River began when I was working for the newspaper. Got to go on a BLM tour out there one day, and that was before any of the events of the 1990s bringing the LDS Church back into the valley had yet occurred. But at that time I thought, wouldn't it make a great book about the West someday if you could trace all the documentation of what it took to put the Sun Ranch together? The Sun Ranch at one time stretched all the way from Devil's Gate to about 6 miles north of Rawlins, that's 55 or 60 miles, and a long way west also. It may have been as much as 500,000 acres. Do you know that country out there? Has everyone driven through the Sweetwater Valley? It's a splendid piece of the world, and I must say I've come to love it very much. I worked at the Casper Star from 1987 through 1998, and then when I was done and was finally working for myself, I was able to finally get a chance to spend some more time with this subject, and that gave rise to this book. I really wrote the book so that I could write the last chapter in the book, which is the chapter about what happened in the 1990s when the Sun family was coming, split the ranch, and then part of it got sold to the LDS Church. I was working at the paper some of the time when that was going on, but the more recent disputes, especially over access and about ownership, happened after I left the paper. So it's a fascinating subject to me, and I wrote the whole book because the book is not just about those events. The book is about all kinds of events that have happened in the Sweetwater Valley since about 1830. I really wrote the book so that I could put the recent disputes over land and access at Martin's Cove into a much larger and longer historical context of all kinds of things that have gone on there. Independence Rock and Devil's Gate, as you know, are important landmarks on the Oregon Trail, and so 500,000 people used that trail between 1843 and 1869, and because it was so heavily used, it was heavily documented. So there is just tons and tons and tons of stuff written down about it at the time because a lot of people came by there. And among those people were Brigham Young in 1847 and the Handcart Brigades in 1856, but also John C. Fremont in 1842 and a lot of Army guys in the 1850s and 60s. There were Ferdinand V. Hayden, the government scientist after the Civil War. There were surveyors, there were ranchers, there was the Pathfinder Dam was the second big dam the Bureau of Reclamation ever built. So all these things are in that book, and the Mormon stuff is kind of in there all the way through, sort of holding the book together. So that's just sort of where I'm coming from. I'm not Mormon myself. I suspect this being asked, and that one or two of you might be. And so I hope we can. So once we can get the pictures going again here, which I hope will happen shortly, then we can go through the talk, and we can have time for questions afterwards, if that's okay with everybody. Okay. Can everybody hear me? Can you hear me back there? Okie doke. I was a little nervous there, I must confess. Martin's Cove, public land, sacred land. What I want to be talking tonight is about the sort of intersection between these interests and occasional conflict, but I think now we've reached a quite reasonable compromise there at Martin's Cove, but we're going to take about 150 years to get there. So,
Tom,
yes?
Will your remote reach to the other side of the desk so that you can step back there from our...
Oh, would you rather... Am I still in your way of the screen? Yeah, okay.
You need a chair if you'd like.
Yeah, I'd rather stand up. I'll...
This one is the one
over here. I have to use this one? Okay, all right.
Sit down and enjoy yourself.
Yeah, here. This is a picture taken by the pioneer photographer William Henry Jackson in 1870, looking up the Sweetwater from the top of Independence Rock. Martin's Cove is actually right around the corner to the right, just out of the picture. And I just love Jackson's photographs, and these are just a little bit of scenery here to get us acclimated to where we are. So the Sweetwater is flowing towards us here. The Sun Ranch headquarters is now right up, and the now Martin's Cove Visitor Center is up, I think, inside this meander. You see that great little wagon there, and there's a little guy there. Martin's Cove would have been on up around the corner here to the right. This is another shot, probably taken a day later, looking up further up the Sweetwater towards Split Rock. I think that's one of the... I just love that photograph. I love that country out there. And then here we are looking downstream through Devil's Gate, also a Jackson photo from 1870. This is a Tom Ray photo from a couple of years ago. You know, it's funny, but this PowerPoint projector makes everything just a little greener than it is in real life, so it makes the valley out there look even lovelier. And here's a picture of Devil's Gate now. This was taken just this past winter, in December or so, a little bit of ice on the river. But now, let's start the story with this man. This is Brigham Young in about the middle 1850s. As perhaps many of you are quite aware, he arrived in the Salt Lake Valley in 1847 with that first company of 147 of the Saints, traveling from the Missouri River that year. By the first several years in Utah were quite prosperous, and everyone was getting very well organized. And as I was learning more about this, I was amazed. I was quite impressed and amazed at how highly organized the whole immigration system was, especially for the immigrants coming from England and from Scandinavia. They had crops were good. They had six or seven quite prosperous years, and then two very bad years in 1855 and 6, if I've got this right, and the crops failed. And Brigham and his counselors were quite sure that it was the people's fault that things were going wrong, and that they needed to re-declare their faith. And so there was a kind of a new wildfire of fundamentalism really sweeping through Salt Lake. There was a lot of preaching, there was a lot of scolding going on, and at the same time there was just a lot less money in the Salt Lake Valley to help people come to Utah. And so that's when Brigham came up with this idea of hand carts, which was a cheap and efficient, fast way to get people across the plains. In 1856, the first three companies worked quite well, but those last two companies, which were much, much larger than any of the first three, got a late start for a whole variety of reasons, starting in Liverpool, with bad sailing dates, with
ships that left late, and finally they did not, the Willie and Martin companies did not depart, as you all know, I'm sure, from the Missouri River until August. The Willie Company left first, I think the first or second week of August, and the Martin Company did not leave till the 20-something of August, 1856, headed for Utah with 1,000 miles to go. Perhaps you've seen this photo before. I like this photo. These are Mormon missionaries in Liverpool in 1855, and many of the main players in this story are in this photo. This is Franklin D. Richards, who was in charge of all Mormon missions in Europe. This is Edward Martin, who was the captain of the Martin Handcart Company. This is Joseph A. Young, a son of Brigham Young, who was one of the scouts who first found the Martin Company when it was so stuck at Red Buttes, just west of where Casper is now. This is Heber Kimball, this is George D. Grant. These were two of the main men of that missionary group, and that year, 1856, they were also traveling back to Utah, as was Franklin Richards. And they had much faster carriages and horses and passed the handcart companies on the way. And so they got to Utah by the 2nd of October or something like that and brought word to the valley that these other people were still coming late. And Brigham Young and other people said they had not expected them to come, although it's unclear to me how much they had expected them to come. The whole handcart system depended on a well-developed system of supply along the way, food and other stuff for the handcarters, so they wouldn't have to carry so much with them. So Franklin Richards, for example, bought a whole bunch of buffalo robes, which he left for them at Fort Laramie, which they picked up on the way. Let me back up here and say, tonight, my wife always says, say what you're going to say it, and then say what you've said, okay? So I haven't told you everything I'm going to say. This talk has three parts. First, I'm going to just talk about the events of 1856. Then I'm going to jump ahead to 1930, when there were huge gatherings at Independence Rock and a new kind of self-conscious nostalgia about the past that coincided exactly with the rise of tourist business and the idea of historical tourism. There were big gatherings of Boy Scouts and Mormon people at Independence Rock on the 4th of July, 1930. And that was the time when Martin, what we think of now as Martin's Cove, became sort of officially located. Then we'll jump ahead again to the 1990s at the time that the Sun family, which had branched at Devil's Gate since 1872 or perhaps earlier, was finally having family difficulties that made it necessary to divide the ranch, and then half the ranch got sold to the Mormon Church, and I'll talk specifically about how those events came about. My main source of information for that whole series of events was a man you may know, Scott Lorimer, the former president of the Riverton Stake. So that's what we're going to talk about tonight, and then when I'm done talking, I'd sure like to hear what you guys can enlighten me or any questions you might care to ask. Again, this guy who looks just like my brother-in-law, this guy here, is Franklin D. Richards. If you could imagine him in a pair of white shoes and plaid pants playing golf, he looked just like my brother-in-law. And this is Edward Martin here. This is Joseph A. Young. This is Heber Kimball, right? And this is George D. Grant. Next picture, I think, is a map. Oh, this is Fremont's map, which is I just happen to love that map. That's the Sweetwater Valley there, and those are the Wind Rivers. And those are the maps probably that the handcarters might well have been using. And here's a more useful map of Wyoming. Here is the Oregon Trail, the Mormon Trail. Here's the split, and here's the way to Salt Lake City. As perhaps you know, the handcarters, when they got to Deer Creek, where Glen Rock is now, the weather was still fine. This was mid-October. They left a lot of their clothes and bedding there because they were still, the carts had green wood and they were undersupplied and they were late and slow and the carts kept falling apart and they had such a late start anyway. So it was clear that if they were going to get to Utah in time, they needed to speed up. So Captain Martin made everyone reduce what they were carrying in their carts to, I think it was 17 pounds per person. By this time, I think they were already down to 4 ounces of flour per person per day. That's about two biscuits. And so they left a good deal of their warm clothes and their bedding there at Deer Creek. And then the next day they got to the river crossing at Casper. They were crossing the river about where Fort Casper is now, if you know where that is in Casper, near Mills, right across, we call it the Mills Bridge. That was the main crossing point. And as they were crossing that day, that was October 19th, 1856, it started to snow. And it snowed very hard, and you know how it is when you get those early, wet, heavy snows where the snowflakes are the size of butter plates. It was one of those kind of snows, and they were already in quite weak shape, and so they got very wet crossing the river, and then there was no way to dry out and warm up. There was no way. And so so they were stuck there at Red Buttes. This is the Martin Company. The Willie Company by then that was hit by the same storm. They, however, were up on the upper Sweetwater by then, and they were also stalled by bad weather and bad carts and their own weakened condition. So everybody was in terrible shape. Here's a more close-up of the whole Sweetwater Valley in central Wyoming. Here's Rollins, here's Casper, here's that same road, and so they were stuck here at Red Buttes, which is near Bessemer Bend, just west of Casper. Perhaps you know where that is if you've ever been to Casper. And they were able to get, 10 miles or so beyond the crossing, but no more. And they were at Red Buttes for 9 days, not eating, not moving. And many, many people died right here. In fact, the only counting that was ever done, that was ever written down of how many people died was right here. And there were 56 people who died before they left Red Buttes. There were about 575 people in the Martin Company, something like that. And then there was another wagon train right behind them of with wagons, the Hunt and Hodgett wagon trains. So there were actually two of them, fairly small, but they had oxen and wagons. And they were almost traveling with the Martin Company. So you had the Willie Company up here, you had the Martin Company back here, and you had the two wagon trains pretty much catching up with them. Some of them got warp rides on those wagons across the river. Meanwhile, back in Utah, to his credit, as soon as Franklin Richards arrived in Utah, Brigham Young realized something needed to be done right away. This is to his great credit. So immediately the rescue expedition was organized and the wagons started coming out across the trail to meet the people. They had expected to be meeting immigrants as soon as Fort Bridger, and were quite surprised, in fact, when they got there and there was nobody there, so they kept going and still no people. Finally, they met the members of the Willie Company just a little ways below South Pass. They left some of their rescue wagons here and proceeded with 10 or a dozen more on down the Sweetwater to Devil's Gate, and then parked the rest of the wagons there and sent those three scouts, Joseph A. Young, Dan Jones, and I think Abel Garr is the third, is that right? And they went on, those three scouts then went on to Red Buttes, where they found the stranded Martin Company who were completely out of steam. They got them moving again, and then came back to Devil's Gate to tell their main party of the rescuers what was up. So then they got their wagons moving, and the actual site of the main first rescue meeting was here on Horse Creek, which the Mormons called Greasewood Creek, I think, if I've got that right, but this is now known as Horse Creek. And so that was where the initial real rescue occurred, was right there. And then they got the people moving. Pardon me? Then they got the people moving, and they were all at Devil's Gate by about the 2nd, I think, or 3rd of November, as they were all finally rolling in. And there were some recently abandoned traders' cabins there. They tore out a wall or two of those cabins and built big fires, and people sang a lot of songs, and it must have been a huge feeling of positive relief and encouragement. There was still not nearly enough food to go around or warm clothes, and the weather was still very, very cold. And so they moved up into the rocks to get out of the wind. They went up the river a couple of miles, crossed it, and pulled up into a cove in the rocks. They stayed there a week, or nearly so, 5 or 6 days anyway, before they could all get rolling again. And first, no one knew what to do exactly. But then the solution presented itself with those wagons there. And so it occurred to everyone that they could unload those wagons, many of which had commercial freight in them bound to Utah under contract, and store the stuff in the wagons in those trader cabins for the winter, and the sickest and weakest people could then start riding in the wagons, which is what they did. So people must have been dying all along the trail here. Some died here at Devil's Gate and Martin's Cove, and they kept on dying all the way across. The Martin Company finally arrived in Salt Lake City on the 30th of November, if I remember this right. So it was the worst non-military disaster on the Western Trails. About 150 people died in the Martin Company, and 60 or 70 people died in the Willie Company. And it's a very important thing that happened there. And the whole question of why did it happen and how did it happen is worth talking about and worth thinking about, and the responsibility for those decisions is worth thinking about. We can talk more about that later. For now, though, I just want to get us moving along through time. Okay? That's sort of the end of part one there. This guy, this is Tom's son, who was a prospector and a hunting guide and a Indian fighter and a general man of all skills in the late 1860s and 1870s in central Wyoming. Sometime during that time, he established what I think was probably a hunting camp at Devil's Gate, and he was guiding well-heeled hunting customers, you know, English lords and stuff, through the 1870s around the middle of Wyoming, and then he brought in some cattle probably late in the 1870s. I know he trailed at least one herd in all of it from Oregon, which was not uncommon, east to Wyoming in 1882. He was well established at Devil's Gate by 1880. His first land claim is around that time. And he's a very interesting guy that we could spend the whole evening on, but we won't. I just want you to know when he got there and who he was. And then we're going to jump ahead again. And this is Ezra Meeker, who many of you may know about also. Ezra Meeker was one of the first real... Ezra Meeker, who was, I think, a few years older than, maybe as 8 or 10 years older than Tom's son, and yet he lived so long into the 20th century that his life is a wonderful joining of the pioneer times and our modern automobile times. Ezra Meeker crossed the trail in 1852 himself with his family. He was from the Midwest, and they ended up in Washington State, and their family founded the town of Puyallup, Washington. He made and lost two fortunes. And in 1906, when he was 75 years old, he started to think, you know, that Oregon Trail is an important thing and people ought to know about it. So Ezra and a wagon and his two favorite oxen, Twist and Dave, and an ox driver, walked from Washington to Washington, from Washington State to Washington, D.C. in 1906. Stopping at clubs along the way and talking to groups and stopping in newspaper offices and getting news stories written about himself. And he had a couple books himself about the Oregon Trail and his own past that he'd written that he would sell along the way, and he sold souvenir postcards. He was really a master public relations guy, and as you can see, the reason I like this photograph so much is it shows how well aware he was of what a good-looking guy he was and how he used that image. You know, he really was kind of a Father Time kind of guy. And so even though he was probably 10 years older than Tom's son, he represents a kind of 20th century nostalgia and self-consciousness about the West and the Western past that is kind of a new layer of thinking about it. You know, if you think about the Buffalo Bills Wild West show, which started in the early 1880s and ran for 30 years, 1883 to 1913, that too was built on a kind of nostalgia for a fast vanishing West, you know, that we still feel all the time about about this wonderful place we live in. And Ezra was especially conscious of that. He crossed the Oregon Trail, I think, four more times. He did it twice more on foot. He did it once by automobile. And he did it once in 1923 in an open cockpit airplane with his false teeth in his pocket for safekeeping. He was by then well into his 90s. He founded the Oregon Trail Memorial Association, which actually got a lot of money from J.P. Morgan and the Kodak Eastman family and other well-heeled money sources like that. And they set up an office in New York City to start institutionalizing the memorialization of the Oregon Trail. And Ezra was the founder and sort of the main figurehead. Who would be better? That also, it's interesting to me, when I learned that their offices were paid for by the American Highway Contractors Association. So what was happening here was the automobile was becoming a new way for people to travel, and it gave people a new way to kind of think about time and distance right there in the 1920s. So there was this lobby that knew that America needed much better roads for all these automobiles to drive on, and it was right in there with the Oregon Trail Memorial Association's new ways of looking at the American past. The next step is this man. This is Howard Driggs, who was born in Pleasant Grove, Utah in 1873, and had a whole first career and a half as a teacher of teachers. He taught at normal schools, educating teachers in Utah for a long time, and wrote a lot of books for children, for boys especially, sort of adventure, semi-true books about the West. And then he went to New York City in 1916, I think it was, and he got a job at New York University in the education department there. And then he took a leave of absence, and what happened is he ended up hooked up with the Oregon Trail Memorial Association. He was a brilliant organizer and kind of a mover and shaker and schemer. In 1928, I think it was, or 9, just a few weeks before 1928, Ezra Meeker died, but by then Driggs was really running the organization, and Driggs persuaded President Hoover to declare in 1930 the centennial of the Oregon Trail for fairly arbitrary reasons, but Driggs promoted several large events to celebrate that anniversary. There was one on Governor's Island in New York, there was one in St. Louis, there was one at Fort Laramie, but the biggest of all of them was at Independence Rock over the 4th of July, 1930. Also there was this man, and now you can tell this isn't 1930 King. This is 1870. This is William Henry Jackson, the pioneer photographer. Red Buttes is right behind you where you are in this picture. This is the Platte River right over here. This is just west of Casper. This pasture is now owned by a rancher named Stacy Scott. And this is, look at that hat brim there. Keep that in your visual memory. This is Jackson in his own photo of the party of the Hayden Survey in the meadow west of Casper in 1870. Well, what these guys did, Driggs, and another man named Robert Ellison, who was president of the Midwest Refinery in Casper, who was a history buff, they kind of rediscovered William Henry Jackson, who by now was in his 80s, who had crossed the trail himself in 1866. Jackson was living in Washington by then. He'd had a long career as a very successful commercial photographer. And they got him painting pictures again. He had been an artist in his youth, and these are what the pictures look like. This very smooth, contoured Independence Rock here, and here's Devil's Gate out here, and here's the Sweetwater, and here are the ox-drawn covered wagons going by. And I like that picture because I think it's a nice kind of stylized smoothing of the past, which is exactly what was going on then. So Jackson too became linked up with the Oregon Trail Memorial Association. Jackson really replaced Ezra Meeker as sort of the official codger guy, the official spokesperson. So they put this whole event together in 1930, which was primarily, first of all, a Boy Scout event, Boy Scouts from all over the country came to Independence Rock for this celebration of the Oregon Trail. Here's probably the most glamorous of all the Boy Scouts who came. These are one boy from each of New York's five boroughs getting a letter from New York Governor Franklin D. Roosevelt, not yet president, handing a letter to the scoutmaster here to deliver a letter of greeting to deliver to Governor Emerson of Wyoming. These boys rode from New York to Independence Rock in this called the Otsmobile, which Henry Ford had actually made for Ezra Meeker for him to make a last and final trip, but Ezra had died before that was possible, so these Boy Scouts got to use it. Ezra Meeker's famous Otsmobile. It says, over the old Oregon Trail, it says. I love this photograph. I love it that Roosevelt's on a horse, so that just everything's great about that. Okay, so here, so over the 3rd, 4th, 5th of July, 6th, 1930, there were between 3 and 15,000 people at Independence Rock, depending on what newspaper you read. This is, and the crowd, I'm sure, was fluctuating all that time, so they had pageants, they had speeches, they had, the boys all swam in the river, they had a rodeo, they had, and the pageant consisted of an attack on a wagon train, so that there was some wagons, and then there were some Shoshone Boy Scouts from the reservation who dressed up as the Indians, okay, who galloped in and attacked the wagon train and were driven off by the by a troop of mounted Boy Scouts in uniform. There was an Indian singer named Chief Tecumseh from Omaha who sang a dramatic song from the top of the rock. There was a meeting of the Masons on the top of the rock. Members only. The first Masonic meeting in Wyoming was on the top of Independence Rock in 1862. This was a commemoration of that. This man, a Jesuit priest from St. Louis, gave a speech about Father de Smet. And I love this woman's posture here. Look at her crossed ankles. Isn't that great? She just doesn't look too impressed by this guy. But you can see, so there were 500 or 600 Boy Scouts camped there, their tents in big semicircles, and there were thousands of people who came out from Rollins and from Casper to be there. A man in Casper named Thad Walker, who's still around, remembers that day. He was 7 years old, and he remembers the heat, and he remembers the smell of the latrines. He was a young boy. I don't mean to take anything away from that either. I mean, this was really a very sort of amazing thing. And when you go out there now and you see those bronze plaques that are in the rock, many of them were put up that day. And there was also a strong and slightly separate Mormon contingent that came over from Salt Lake City. They arrived and they camped together, and they also had a new sign put up on the rock to commemorate the 1847 passage past the rock. The fact that they only painted their sign that year and didn't get their bronze plaque up until a year or two later makes me wonder if Ellison and Drakes weren't a little bit late about including them in the festivities. I don't know, but they were there, and then the next day they went over to the Sun Ranch and put up some plaques there and had some speeches there. The following year, 1931, was a very similar but much smaller gathering, also at the Rock, but this was much more of a strictly LDS event. This was on the 84th anniversary in late June of the 1847 party passing there. This is Heber J. Grant, president of the Mormon Church. This is Grant. This is William Henry Jackson, the pioneer photographer, with his hat brim still just a little turned up, dapper, small man. This is former Wyoming Governor B.B. Brooks giving a speech. You see the President Grant here isn't too impressed by Governor Brooks either. Looks like a very hot day. This was June 21, I think. And you can see the plaque there in the photo, which is still up there, which is, says the Mormon Pioneers there. So this was commemorating that event. There's another photo from the same event. And then here are Heber J. Grant, and this is George Albert Smith, who would succeed President Grant as president of the Mormon Church also. As I'm sure many of you know, there had already by this time been a long and close relationship between the Mormon Church and Boy Scouting. The Boy Scouts of America was founded in 1910 or 1911, and within a year the Mormon Church became the first denomination to ever kind of formally accept Scouting as part of its ministry, and that was largely because of George Albert Smith. And as I read about him, and people always seem to find this guy a mild and lovable person who solved disputes by his own mildness. He was also one of the main officers of the Utah Pioneer Trails Association. And when George Albert Smith got back to Salt Lake City on that Monday after that weekend, he announced to the Deseret News, after their festivities at the Rock, they went over to the Sun Ranch, and this time they actually went out to where they were pretty sure Martin's Cove was. And it was after that when they got back to Utah, George Albert Smith announced to the world, and the story ran in the Deseret News that next day, that Tuesday, in late June in 1931, that the place that Martin's Cove essentially had been located. George Albert Smith had just said, this is where it was. There was, then and now, there's no archaeological evidence that's ever been discovered there to confirm which of those coves in the rock it might have been. The documentary evidence from the time is very sketchy. No one was keeping a journal at all in the Martin Company. Brother Burton in the rescue company was keeping. He's quite vague about where the people pulled up out of the wind. And then Daniel Jones, who was captain of the party that stayed there over the winter, wrote a memoir 30 some years later, published in 1890. Maybe you've read this book. It's called 40 Years Among the Indians. It's just a great, great book. And Dan Jones located it, not very specifically, also just saying, I think, 2 miles or a mile and a half or something west of where the cabins were. So it had to be somewhere, and this is as likely a place as any. But it was interesting to me to find that story in the Deseret News and to think of this as something that kind of had to be done right at about that time, that George Albert Smith realized, oh, we have to say where this is. So a couple of years later, they got back to the valley and put up this marker that's still there. People call it the George Albert Smith Monument. This is on the old highway, which goes through the, which used to go past the front gate of the Sun Ranch and still goes right past the Mormon Handcart Visitor Center. And it marks the spot, sort of. I'll show you in a minute what I mean by sort of. Meanwhile, so that's the events of 1930 and 31. The reason that was so interesting to me was that it showed a new interest or a rebirth of interest or something of the LDS Church in the Sweetwater Valley. By that time, there was no one left alive who had been there in 1856, and so these were descendants of those initial pioneers. Now we're back at the Sun Ranch. This is the front gate of the Sun Ranch, photo in about 1940. This is Adelaide Sun, granddaughter of Tom Sun, who we saw in that first picture holding a pool cue. And this used to be called the Gate of Perfect Balance. It was right across the front, where you drove into the ranch yard. This bunkhouse is still there. And this is a big heavy beam here, and here's the Sun Hub and Spoke brand on that cow skull. And this was a trough here weighted with a lot of rocks, but weighted so perfectly that somebody the size of Adelaide Sun reportedly could push that gate open with one finger. Isn't that great? When they first made it, it was held together with telegraph wire, which was still hanging around out there, and then later repaired with these leather strips. The Sun Ranch in the 19 grew slowly, fairly slowly in the 1920s and 30s, and then after World War II, there were several sons, all of the same generation. And this family story is that their father just wanted to make sure they all had enough to do, so he kept buying up more ranches. By the mid 1970s, the Sun Ranch was as big as I mentioned earlier. That is, it went all the way from Devil's Gate almost to Rollins and on far west into the Red Desert. There was really wasn't fenced on the west side at all, and some cattle would, you know, turn up in Farson from time to time. So that's a lot of country. And it was really, it's one of the last, you know, great ranching empires lasted far into the 20th century, and a big chunk of it is still there. It's not like it's gone. Okay, now we're leaping forward again. I should say that by the late 1970s and early 1980s, there was a lot of strain on the Sun family and on their ranch. Part of it was financial. Beef prices were low and interest rates were very high in the early 1980s. And also the two main sons who were running the show then, Bernard's son and his brother John Hughes' son, just weren't really getting along very well at all. Bernard was ranching at the old historical core of the ranch at Devil's Gate, and his brother John Hugh had a house all the way down near Rollins. John Hugh was running a much drier, much larger part of the ranch, and Bernard was up there, kind of in where they'd always been sons. And there must have been personal things going on between them at the same time, and things were getting worse and worse gradually through the 1980s and into the early 1990s. Then this man comes into the story. This is Robert Scott Lorimer from Riverton, New Jersey, businessman in Riverton. He was president of the Riverton Steak at the time, and he got a feeling, a revelation, I think you would call it, help me on this, that the souls of the departed Martin Willie Hancock Company pioneers needed help, needed work, needed temple work. And so he and his top three counselors had this strong feeling, and they soon had the whole stake working on this question. So there were something like 1,400 pioneers in those two companies, plus the wagon trains. Many, many, many of them had never been baptized. They were all new converts, and many of them had died unbaptized, and so they wanted to baptize them and perform sealings and marriages, and so they did. They had recently gotten linked up by computers to the great Mormon resources of archives and genealogical databases, so they could do the work that way and then find out who each of these people were and who they were related to. And they started in on that work, and it was thousands and thousands of hours of work, and it involved many, many trips back and forth from Riverton to Ogden, where the nearest temple was, to do the temple work. So this got everybody pretty excited and pretty fired up, and Scott deserves a lot of credit for this amazing kind of leadership that he acted on. And out of that came a desire to put up a monument at Martin's Cove. This is the wonderful ambiguity of this marker. Is that Martin's Cove, or is that Martin's Cove? I was watching TV the other day, and somebody was talking about Prime Minister Tony Blair and his effect on the whole settlement moving towards settlement of the difficulties in Ireland, and somebody was praising Tony Blair for his constructive ambiguity. And I think there's a little bit of that going on here. So, anyway, this one on the right is now what we call Martin's Cove. There's still a lot of dispute among people. Many of the church historians are quite convinced that the immigrants pulled up along this side. And there are other historians who there's a little pocket here behind this spur of rock where many other people are more than non-Mormon historians are convinced that the people must have pulled up. The river is here. The river is between us and the cove here. I need a better photo of this that makes it clearer where the river is. This is the old highway right here. We're looking north across the river and up into Martin's Cove. So, in the summer of 19... So there was a story about Scott and the Riverton Steak's efforts in the fall of 1991 in the Deseret News, and there was another... And then they persuaded the BLM to allow them to put up a monument up here in the cove. This land up here, it was federal land. It was part of a Sun Ranch grazing lease. And So the BLM had to be in on this deal, and the Suns had to be in on this deal for access, because this along the river, it's all private Sun land at the time. Now it's private church land. But they wanted to put up a monument up there. So that was okay with the BLM. The people from the church wanted to put up, logically enough, a large monument that you could see from down here on the road. And the BLM said, no, that won't do. We need a smaller monument. So they put up a smaller monument that you can't see from the road. But then that began to beg the question of, well, how are we going to get up there if this is private land in between? And a second story ran in the Deseret News in August of 1992. And before long, there were a fair number of LDS people turning up on the Sun Ranch with some regularity saying, I want to go to Martin's Cove. Many of them thought the church already owned it, which when you read those stories, you can see why they might think so, although the story didn't say so. The Suns found themselves having to pull stuck trucks out of the river, and there was a lot of not great feeling going on either way. President Gordon B. Hinckley, who by then was still one of the top three counselors of the Mormon Church and not yet president of the whole church, was at that little ceremony they had in that summer of 1992 for that new monument there. And the church had also put up some new monuments for the Willie Company up closer to South Pass that year. So he was doing a memorializing little trip there of several ceremonies. And after they were done there in Martin's Cove that day, Scott Lorimer was there, and Gordon B. Hinckley turned to Scott and said, so do you think we could work out some more permanent way to have some kind of access up into the cove? And Scott said, yeah, I think we probably could. And so he deputized Scott to talk to the Sons to try to work something out. So that's when Scott really started getting to know Bernard's son. Bernard, remember, was the brother who was ranching there at Devil's Gate. And they talked and talked and talked, and finally had an agreement between the two men, which was that there would be a right-of-way a mile wide along the river here, so that anyone could go from the old highway up into the cove. There would be a bridge over the river. There would be underpasses for the cattle to get. There would be a road, I guess, or a path. There would be underpasses for the cattle to get through the right-of-way section of land. The church would pay a cash payment, or maybe an annual payment, to the Sons. Scott would not tell me how much that was. And that was the agreement. So Scott then, this was still in 1992, wrote Salt Lake about it and didn't hear a word. And waited and waited and waited and didn't hear and didn't hear. Finally, let's see if I can get the sequence of events right. Yeah. Then in 1994, he still hadn't heard anything, but there was another group of kids had come up to Martin's Cove, and Scott was talking to them one day up in the cove. So they must have gotten an okay, I guess, from the Sons to get up in there. And Scott was talking to a couple of hundred young people from Colorado up in here, and he's very good at telling those stories, and he understands this history so very well, and he's such a good speaker. And when he was done, the whole group meeting was starting to break up, and people were coming down and starting to come, some of them wading the river, some of them going back down other ways. And Scott was still up in here, and from up there, you could look down to your left. Oops. Oh, excuse me a second. I know right what to do about this.
Don't worry. Go. This is the computer telling me I'm staying too long in one picture.
Scott was up in his cove and he suddenly sees Bernard's truck tearing down along this old beat-up asphalt road, pulling into the gravel here by the monument, spraying gravel, and Bernard, who by then is a man in his 70s, jumping out and looking pretty upset. He sees Scott from a distance. He says, "Scotty, get over here." And so Scott goes over and starts talking to him, and they start walking along the road together back towards the ranch house. And Scott says, and Bernard was obviously very, very upset. And Scott said, what happened? What's the matter? And he said, they threw me out. And he said, what do you mean they threw you out? They threw me out. Well, what had happened was that there had been this whole division in the family had finally come to a head at a meeting of the Sun Landing Cattle Company shares holders, which was the family, and Dennis' son, who's a nephew of Bernard and John Hugh, had shifted his vote, so that Dennis was now ready to vote with John Hugh instead of with Bernard. Dennis, Bernard's nephew, had kind of been the ramrod of the ranch there at Devil's Gate for about, I think, 10 years or more by that time. And so Bernard felt betrayed. This is a sad story. And they were walking along, and Scott said he looked over at Bernard, and this old tough man with a hat on, and tears come down his face. So that shifted the whole balance, and it was not long after that that the family realized that they had to divide the ranch for these kinds of mix of personal and just regular ranch business reasons. And so they worked out an I cut, you choose agreement. This is how my brother and I used to divide a piece of chocolate cake. Do you guys do this? So that, you know, one kid gets to cut it and the other decides which half he wants. Well, the same thing with this enormous ranch. If Bernard really wanted to be the one who drew the line, and so that was okay. So actually, on behalf of her father, Tina's son, who's about my age, drew the line. And she had grown up on the hub and spoke. They call it the spoke, which means she had grown up right there at Devil's Gate. She and her brothers had a very strong feeling for it. And so she divided the ranch, not in half at all, but with maybe a fourth or a fifth of the actual territory, is what she drew a line around. So that included the hub and spoke and a couple pieces of land on the east side of the highway called the Bar 11 Ranch and the Beef Acre. To her surprise and Bernard's surprise, John Hugh picked that smaller half. So that meant that the ranch was now going to be divided, and at the same time, Scott was there that day also when that division happened, and Dennis came out of the house and said, Bernard doesn't own what you want. So it was shortly after that, then, that negotiations started in earnest with the church, and the church ended up buying the smaller, more historic half. The deal was that once they agreed on a price, they put the money in an escrow account, and then they took that money, and the two son boys, John Hughes' two sons, Steve's son and Jess, went and found two other ranches, one in western Nebraska and one in western Kansas. And so then that money went to buy those two ranches, and it was a straight-across deal. This is not uncommon in the real estate world, and it saves the seller from having to pay capital gains for another generation, I think, is why you do that. Pardon me? And so the price, I don't know. Tina mentioned $5 million to me, but she didn't know either because it wasn't her deal. So that's how that happened. Meanwhile, so then Martin's Cove itself was still a Sun Ranch grazing lease that went with the ranch, but of course that was what the church was, of course, so deeply interested in. And so the church and the BLM worked out a 5-year agreement starting in 1997, which guaranteed public access and that it would always be free and open. And that there would be certain improvements. A path, that nice gravel path out there that goes out there, was built mostly with BLM materials and church labor, and then the church had the land there and started changing and building, adding extra buildings to what we have now. And there things pretty much stayed. Now here we are looking west again up the Sweetwater Valley. Martin's Cove is right around the corner to the right up here. Here's Split Rock that was in the Jackson picture. This was taken May last year. And so that agreement expired was due to expire in 2002, and that's when the church started to move to actually try to find a way to purchase the land outright. There had been some talk about land swaps, but the church and the BLM were unable to find anything agreeable to both sides, and so Representative Jim Hansen of Utah introduced a bill in his committee in Congress for an outright purchase of, I think it was 1,640 acres of federal land at Martin's Cove by the LDS Church. And that bill, and Barbara Cuban was on that committee, our congresswoman from Wyoming, was on that committee, and she was in a very difficult position. She had a committee chairman who she needed to have like her, who very much wanted this to go through. She had a lot of constituents in Wyoming who were strongly opposed to this idea. She also had a lot of LDS constituents who really liked the idea. And so she announced that she was against, with Hansen's sort of tacit consent, Barbara Cuban got the bill amended in committee to shrink its size and add a few more caveats about what would happen to any artifacts that might turn up and how they would be preserved. But also, throughout, the idea was that the access would be free and open. And they shrank the size of the sale, the proposed sale, from 1640 to 940 or something like that, in committee. And then on its way out of committee, Barbara voted against the bill. And this confused her constituents a little bit, I think. And then on the day the bill came up for a voice vote on the floor, this was still very much of a local issue in Congress and below the general radar, but it was, as many of you perhaps remember, it was quite controversial in Wyoming at the time. She was coming across Washington after a doctor's appointment with her husband Fritz, and the traffic was really bad, and she missed the vote. However, nevertheless, the bill passed in Congress just by a unanimous, or apparently mostly unanimous, voice vote. But when it got to the Senate, it stalled immediately. Neither Craig Thomas or Mike Enzi liked the idea very much. I think because they were worried about the precedent it would set. I think largely if the federal government land can be sold to groups for religious purposes, it would open a kind of precedent that they did not want to deal with. And I think they must have especially had Indian land, Indian tribes in their mind, and especially places like Devil's Tower. So the following year, and so Craig stopped it pretty much from getting anywhere in the Senate. Representative Hansen even was quite wound up about this and threatened Craig that if any, next time this Thomas bill that was scheduled after to pass the House to go before Hansen's committee, after to pass the Senate to go before Hansen's committee in the House, that he would stop it. And there was that kind of language flying around, and it wasn't very friendly. After the Senate failed to do anything about it, then the next year, Craig, quite quietly, and the BLM and the LDS Church got together and worked out a lease. The church was hoping for a 99-year lease. What they came up with finally was a 25-year lease. And the terms, again, the rent wasn't set until much later, but as it is now, and probably will continue to be, it's a 25-year lease, and the church pays $16,000 a year for that lease on Martin's Cove, which is very high for a grazing lease, which is what it used to be, and quite low, I think, when you think about that they're getting the piece of land that really makes the whole place meaningful. Now you can go out there and you can pull a handcart out to the cove yourself. Maybe many of you have done this. There's just a picture I took of Devil's Gate with just the old corrals in it. Here's the ranch gate now, and here is the parking lot, and there's Devil's Gate in the background. Now, I would argue that Martin's, the former Sun Ranch has become a parking lot for Martin's Cove. So I can stop talking now, and I'd love to hear any questions you might have. Thanks so much for having me. This is a great chance for me to be here in Afton. Thank you.
Sure.
Are there any questions that anyone would like to bring up to Mr. Ray?
Yes, ma'am.
Why were people in Wyoming the ones that killed this against it? Why?
I think they were against it because they didn't feel like public land should be sold to a church. That public land is public land, it's the property of the people of the United States, and if you start selling it for religious reasons, it's not a road they want to go down.
They own that Sunny Ranch, whatever. How big is that the church bought?
I was just looking that up again today. The purchase was 113,000 acres, of which 13,000 were deeded land. No, it was 900 acres.
The cove, the little piece in the cove is just a little bit that matters because they already own that other Sun Ranch. They don't want that whole. I mean, isn't it just a small piece?
No, the piece that was going to be sold was 940 acres. I think I've got this right. Yeah.
940.
Yeah, that's like a section and a half. Originally, it had been larger than that. It had been like 1,600 and some, or something like that. But then, after the bill came out of committee, when it got voted on in the House, it was down to 900 and some acres. So it's pretty much the whole cove there, which is a big piece of ground. Yes.
I was told one of the concerns that they had, if they felt like that, if they started selling off things to the church like that, and there's a lot of Indians around here.
I think was definitely on Craig Thomas's mind and Mike Enzi's mind, and that was the main reason they didn't want to see it, anything other than what happened. Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
So after 25 years, they have to negotiate again.
That's right. That's right. Which many of the opponents of the sale thought that was way too long of a lease. The church wanted 99 years, so you get something that nobody exactly writes, likes. That's politics. Yes.
What happened to the other son that got the
turkey there? Tina and her brothers are still ranching on what's called the Turkey Track, which is about 5 or 8 miles further west up the Sweetwater towards Split Rock. And then they still have a lot of land out west and south of there. The ranch no longer is as big as it was. They sold off some of those extremely dry southern pieces in the 80s, I think. So it's not as big as it was, but it's still what they have in terms of acres is bigger than what the church has, but it's less cool.
You know Norman Park?
Yes.
We sell him bulls.
We've slept at the dumbbell.
Have you? Well, Gay Nell and Norman were, especially Gay Nell, who, as you may know, talks a little more than Norman does. She helped me a lot in this book. Yeah.
Dennis was at our bull sale. Dennis.
Okay.
Interesting fellow.
Yeah.
Publishes in the Wyoming Roundup
paper. Yeah. Yeah. Works for the state. Yeah.
Numbers looking like for, how good is it for Casper and Rollins? How many people are coming?
Would you like me to be frank about this?
Yes.
I don't know. But in the first years after it was open to visitors, they were getting 40,000 people a year, they said, who were coming to visit Martin's Cove. Many people in Casper think that a lot of those people who come over from Utah to visit Martin's Cove don't come into Casper and stay in motels and eat in our restaurants. So we encourage you to do that if you ever come over there. And the one great attraction that you might also enjoy if you're coming to see Martin's Cove is we now have this wonderful museum in Casper called the Historic Trail Center up on the hill near the Events Center. And that's a very good little historical museum. It was built with cooperation of the BLM and LDS Church and a lot of private interests in town. So that's a very great, nice place to stop. They have a special room in there where it's actually cold about Martin's Cove. So go in there and shiver a little bit.
Fort Casper is an interesting
Fort Casper, too. That's right. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Has the new agreement limited the number of visitors?
The number of visitors who can is limited on the treks up by South Pass, especially going over Rocky Ridge, pulling hand carts along those trails, which are so rocky and the soil is so thin. The heavy use it was getting in the first couple of years was too much, and now the BLM has limited the numbers of people per season who can pull a handcart on the upper ends of the trails. But I don't think the numbers are limited at all on Martin's Cove, as far as I know. Do you know otherwise? I think that's right. Yes?
Who is speaking is Honorable Mayor Alan Stauffer, whose great-great-grandfather was Captain Willie.
I thought I recognized him.
We know each other way back. We do.
And perhaps many of you are descendants of William Martin Pioneers. Who? Anyone else? Look at that. Yeah. Yeah. So really, I mean, ask me, I came here to really get, you know, I've said this talk a few times now, and but I really came here to hear what you guys have to say. Yes?
The only glitch I noticed is I think you're not correct about journals. There are so many private journals in families. For instance, in my family, there's a journal about their stock, Martin's Cove. There's some discrepancies to what you said, but very close. I think if you did research in families, because so many Mormon families keep histories, and so few of them get published.
Yeah, and there always might be more that might turn up, too. You're right. The ones I know are from the Hafen book, Handcart's Design, which you may know. And I understood that, perhaps I'm wrong, I thought there were only those two, and really only those one or two that were actually written down at the time. There are many, many memoirs and reminiscences that were written down over the next three decades or so, and a lot of them began, you know, they first began appearing in those kinds of accounts, first began appearing in the Salt Lake Papers in the 1870s, and then there were a lot of them that started to be published in the around after 1900, as those people were getting old and about to pass on. So that's a different kind of value of historical evidence. There's, maybe you guys know this historian, and his last name is escaping me, who lives in Springville, Utah, who's she is writing a book on the Martin Company. It's the first day-by-day account ever written of that event. And then she's cooperating with Gary Long, who worked for the BLM for a long time, on a similar book about the Willie Company. These books will be published here any year now by the University of Utah Press, and they should be very good if you're interested in this subject. Linda Carter is her name, and his name is Gary Long. And they are day by day accounts. And she is the person that I've met that knows those sources better than anyone else I've met. She's very, very good on that subject. Yes?
One time you could drive in a four wheel vehicle from Willie's side to down the Rocky Ridge and so forth. Is that still allowed or is it closed off?
I think that's closed off, but I'm hazy on South Pass. I can't. You need to call the Land or BLM office and know for sure, because that kind of rule could change from one year to another. So I don't know. Oh, what else?
Journals are important. If you read some of the journals of the 75,000 saints that immigrated from England to Salt Lake Valley between 1847 and 1869, when the railroad came, most of them say it was worse crossing the ocean than it was crossing the plains. The average bear today forgets that. But they said they'd rather cross the plains than cross the ocean. But we don't have that gist in our present-day thinking.
Yeah.
You know that, of course.
You will. Yeah, no, I didn't know that. I mean, I'm glad to hear you say that. I know that the Martin Company had a bad time crossing the ocean. Nobody died on the ocean.
Well, it took 50 to 70 days to cross the ocean, 50 to 70 days to cross the plains.
Right.
If you got away from England in March, you'd get to Salt Lake by September.
Right.
But woe be to the Martin and Willie Company. Right. They didn't even get away from England until June.
That's right.
It was too bad right from the first.
Yeah. Crimean War was going on. It was a bad time in England, too. Well, this is a blast. I mean, really, I'm having the time of my life, so, yes?
My great-great-grandmother was 18 when she was with the Hunt Wagon Company, and they needed some help with the sick and the froze, so she helped with the others, and they rushed them on with the wagons. And when they got near Salt Lake, the other lady that was helping had long legs, but some of the livestock are kind of short, and President Cole's wife was the same, you know, we connect up. But she couldn't even walk in the same tracks as this longer lady, but, you know, they made it over anyway.
Good thing. Yeah. I'm so glad to hear that they made it, because I thought you were going to tell me they were one of the people who lost their feet or something.
She was the second wife of a Bishop Stewart that helped with the education there in Draper. Mm-hmm.
Oh, you know, I also forgot to tell you one more legal development, which was that starting in 2005, some people who felt they were being unfairly proselytized when crossing church land on their way to the Cove filed suit against the BLM, claiming that their First Amendment rights to freedom of religion were being abridged. And they were quite upset about this, and one of those people was a guy who teaches at Western Wyoming College. His name's Kevin Holdsworth, and he's, like you, a great great-grandson of two pioneers who died in the Willie County. The ACLU took up this suit for them and filed it, and they settled the suit. Mike Sullivan, our former governor, was a lawyer for the church in those negotiations, and they worked out a system where now you can... there's a different parking situation so that you can park and go across the river and up into the Cove without ever having to go past the visitor center. You know, they have those missionaries out there. And there's a lot of variety in those missionaries. Some are as to how they are about approaching non-Mormons, especially speaking from my own experience. And so I think this thing is probably, again, a compromise that neither side's entirely thrilled about it. And it's probably all right. I think it's all right. So that was good. And then the directors out there revolve every 3 years, too, I think. So it's kind of changing personnel out there. So is that enough? Does everybody want to go home? I have some books for sale. If you want some, I'm happy to sell you some. And if you don't, that's fine, too. And it's great to see you. Thanks also. Yes?
Oh,
you're so welcome. Thank you.